WIOX is supported by you and the following underwriters. Caldwell Banker Timberland Properties, with six offices located throughout the Catskills, serving buyers and sellers of land and homes for over 40 years. Timberland Properties agents live, work, and play locally, with offices in Margaretville, Stamford, Roscoe, Delhi, Sydney, and Boyceville. TimberlandProperties.net, 845-586-3321. 1053 Main Street Gallery in Fleischmann's, designed as a space to support a vibrant and active artistic community nestled within the Catskill Mountains. 1053 Main Street Gallery presents Hidden Gardens, an exhibition of works by the artists of Ad Hoc Projects, a collective of 13 artists striving to bring challenging and provocative diverse works to the Catskills. On view through March 20th. Information about the gallery and upcoming exhibitions at 1053maingallery.com. The Arc Bowl and Barbecue, Route 28 in Arkville, New York. A 120-seat, restored 1960s-era vintage 8-lane bowling alley, barbecue joint, saloon, and music entertainment venue. Featuring a slow, smoked and grilled barbecue menu. The Arc Bowl and Barbecue, available for all types of social events, including weddings, birthday parties, and work gatherings. Details at thearkbowl.com.
Hi, this is Arnie Schwartz, host of Talk of the Town on WIOX Roxbury. I'm also board chair at Margaretville Hospital. I have some important news about new jobs at Margaretville Hospital and Mountainside Residential Care Center. The hospital and the residential care center have an immediate need for experienced and newly graduated registered nurses, LPNs, and certified nursing assistants. New positions are now open, offering competitive salary and benefit packages and significant sign-on and retention bonuses. Learn more at jobs@hahv.org. jobs@hahv.org.
Okay, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC, cable TV, channel 20 on the campus of SUNY Delhi at 107.5 FM, worldwide at WIOXradio.org, and on any mobile device radio FM app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good, Ryan. How are you?
All right. What have you been up to?
Well, I planted a tree yesterday, first in the year.
All right. Nice job.
I giveth back.
You giveth back. After murdering so many trees, John, is that what you're saying?
Well, we talk about cutting them down so often. Yeah. I planted a fruit tree in my yard.
All right. What kind?
Apple.
Yeah. Okay. Honeycrisp?
Yeah, it was a Honeycrisp.
Yeah.
I know. There's so many much more different and better varieties out there. I'll say it like that.
Hey, it's a good tree. It's a good apple. Nothing wrong with that Honeycrisp.
It's not my favorite, but my wife wanted it. She actually bought it. She chose it. She did a good job. I've taught her well.
Happy wife, happy life. No, is that the thing?
Selecting the right tree. She did a good job.
All right. Yeah, you got to look at the roots when you're buying a tree. I've been splitting wood. Took the buckets down. Maple season's over for me. I live at 900 feet in central Ulster County, and they were turning piss yellow and smelling like wet dog hair and stopped running. That means the season's over.
Lovely. So, yeah.
And just splitting wood, restocking what I burned. That's about it. You know, doing some tree work here and there.
Cool. Yep, still pruning apple trees.
Pruning apple trees over in Grahamsville today. Some overly vigorous apple trees. So that's good. But tonight, we are talking about Meat Timber Works Forest Management's Nathan Waterfield over in Cherry Valley, Otsego County. Let me see if I can get him on. Nathan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
How are you doing, man?
Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. How about you?
I'm okay. I think I spoke to you in deposit. Was it the Lumberjack Festival maybe 10 years ago?
It could have been that long.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. And before that, it was probably the Ranger School. So Nathan and I went to the Ranger School in 2004, right?
Yes, where we spent maybe too much time together.
Too much. There's a lot of time. I was trying to explain to people what the Ranger School is like. It's kind of like a prison because you work and live with each other, you know?
Yes. Yes. So. Yeah, it's a completely unique experience. And I think I remember quoting myself or leaving in the yearbook, I can't wait to miss this place, which I do miss it. It was a great opportunity, and to do it all over again. I don't know if you could, but Ranger School is a wonderful program.
It's been so long, I'm not even sure what to call you anymore. Is it Nate, Nathan, or Bucket?
Well, I get called all those. I think they all work. It just depends on how I introduce myself. In the timber sports world, I'm generally referred to as Bucket. But Nathan works, or Bucket, either one, doesn't matter.
All right. Yeah, so we got reacquainted by someone over there in the Clark Foundation, Devin, and he told me that you were out and about, and you know, you're making your living from the woods, from the forest, and we like to interview people like that. So here we go. So tell us about yourself. You know, where you're from. I know where you're from, I think. I mean, I don't know exactly where in Pennsylvania, but yeah. How'd you get into all this?
Yeah, well, I'm 38. And I grew up in northwestern Pennsylvania around the Allegheny National Forest. And that's probably a lot of where my interest in forestry came from. There's a Forest Service office in the town of Warren, which was very close to where I grew up. And I saw that as a potential place for employment, and I knew some of the guys I did sports with, their fathers worked there for the Forest Service, and so that was kind of my initial sort of introduction that forestry was a profession.
And I guess you used to wrestle too. I found an article on you, full disclosure, Nathan. So, you know, I read it a couple times. And, yep. I really like the pictures of you, man, in the timber sports. It was Men's Journal. I saw Men's Journal with your happy face in it. Is that right?
Yeah. Men's Journal, Popular Mechanics. I've had some unique opportunities in my life due to the timber sports stuff. I certainly never imagined it would be like that. But actually, at Ranger School is where I got introduced to it. One of our classmates, Anne, she actually had competed at Finger Lakes Community College and thought we should start a team. And so I worked with her to start a team there at the school, and it just really blew up from there.
John, does Paul Smith have a Timber Sports team?
Yes, they do. I was not.
Isn't that a culinary school?
Oh, man.
Ouch.
Take that, John.
Got me with a low punch right off the bat.
John is a good cook, you know. He can cook pretty well. Did you guys ever compete with them, Nathan?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, and no disrespect to Paul Smith College. I have a lot of great friends and colleagues, and I know a lot of great people from Paul Smith College. I absolutely respect their program, and we competed against them, and yeah, it's definitely one of the other great forestry schools in New York State.
Well, I never competed myself, but I was on the back end of things, helping set up those tournaments and cutting some of that wood. And so I'd always get the ins and outs of what was going on. But at the time, Paul Smith was doing pretty good.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That was back in 2013,
14. Wow, you know.
Yep. They've always been a very competitive, very good team.
I want to ask you one more thing. What weight class did you wrestle at in high school?
I started late, and I think I was a sophomore. It was the first time I ever wrestled, and I wrestled 189. I weighed about 173, just sort of naturally, and then there was many occasions where I also would wrestle heavyweight. I just got sort of juggled around depending on at dual meets how we were going to best score. I love wrestling. I wish I would have started a long time before my sophomore year, but I did enjoy it for the few years I did get to do it.
Yeah, I mean, PA is a big state geographically, but wrestling is pretty popular there. Both of our wrestling coaches in New Paltz were from Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, I think we were sort of in the area of Edinburgh University and Lockhaven, and like they were big collegiate wrestling programs as far as we were concerned. And from the high school standpoint, they had camps and things, and so yeah, it was a big deal, that's for sure. And so was football.
Yeah, I went to Lockhaven for summer camp.
Okay.
Yeah, for wrestling.
Nice. Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
That's cool. No kidding. I didn't wrestle 185 or whatever, but it's more like 96 and 103. You know what I'm saying, John? Although I had to cut to 103 from 121 my senior year. That was not good.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I looked like Skeletor.
It was fortunate that I didn't have to cut weight, because I did not admire those guys. They would cut from like in that 45 to 171, that's where the guys who had been wrestling since they were 4 and 5 years old lived. And
yeah.
that's what pushed me outside of that zone, because they were just so good.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the 140s, and I feel like for the lightweight end, the guys at 125 or a little heavier weight class, they're very competitive. You know, they've been doing it since second, third grade. You know, it's tough.
Yeah.
But, all right, let's get back into this timber sports, because a lot of people don't really know what – some people don't know what that is. I think it's pretty cool. But, can you describe what that is?
Yeah, so timber sports or woodsmen's competitions have been going on in like the northeastern United States, but then kind of like all over the country, and particularly – out west, when the timber industry was really booming, there was a lot of timber sports events sponsored by the lumber companies in the west. And essentially, the sport is a glorification of all of the techniques that were used to fall timber and produce logs before chainsaws were invented. So cross-cut sawing, chopping with axes, bow saws, pole climbing, log rolling, all of that falls under the umbrella of timber sports or wood chopping, lumberjack competitions. The word timber sports is actually a registered trademark, I suppose, for steel, Steel is a huge sponsor and supporter of the sport, and Steel Timber Sports is the most elite competition there is for any of us that do these kind of sports.
So who's like a big deal in this? Like, who's the Tom Brady of Timber Sports?
Well, right now, what is interesting and something I've learned over my career in it is that it's amazing what can be taught to those as passed down from generation to generation. And oftentimes there's no training that can replicate something that's essentially genetic. And Matt Coger is a six-time U.S. champion. He is a third-generation competitor, and he's a professional. He essentially does this for his career. And Jason Lentz is our reigning champion. These guys are from West Virginia, and the lineage is there to back them up. And in fact, the top guys in the sport all now, for the most part, have some kind of family history within the sport. There's so much to it with not only the technique but also the equipment that you have somebody holding your hand at a young age getting into the sport. It's extremely beneficial.
Yeah, I mean, how about axes and stuff? So it says here, Nathan, that you're a three-time winner of the U.S. title springboard?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, yep. Explain
yeah,
that.
I think it's five now.
Watch out.
But the U.S. the U.S. title is essentially, it's the one time a year. It would be the championship for a single discipline. So a lot of times we go to these events, and it's a little bit like a track meet, and there could be anywhere from 6 to maybe 10 or 11 disciplines we would compete in. And the championship or the title for a single discipline is often held at different locations throughout the year. And the springboard is my favorite event. It's the event that I am, I think, most naturally talented in, and one that I've really trained and developed extensively. And so it's a U.S. title. Essentially, there's $1,000 on the line for the winner, and there's a few other criteria. Essentially, there has to be a qualifier, a semifinal, a final. But in general, it's the one race that matters for the year for that discipline.
I mean, we had a surveying lab, and I remember looking over, and you were cutting down a tree with our little snow and Neely axe. But you went crazy afterwards, huh?
Yeah. The year that I graduated after getting my bachelor's from ESF, I had the opportunity to go to Spain for 6 weeks and compete in Spain in some endurance chopping. And then I came home for about, 2 or 3 weeks, not even. Just enough time, essentially, to visit my now wife and propose to her. And then I went to Australia for a little over 6 months and competed in Australia and New Zealand through our winter, their summer, and did probably 30 or more competitions down there, including the Sydney Royal Easter Show, which is, the best I can describe it is, say, the New York State Fairgrounds times two in size, and the event itself is supported by the government. Agriculture has the history of agriculture is really well celebrated in Australia, and it's supported by the government. And so they have a 12-day-long lumberjack competition there. There's a heat of chopping or sawing every 10 minutes for 12 days for 8 hours a day. And the last time I was there was 40 competitors or so. So I've been to that Royal Easter Show, I think, 6 times, and spent probably 18 months or so in Australia competing when I was younger and had less responsibilities.
Yeah, no, I get that. How do they look at trees and forests differently?
Well, in Australia, there's a lot of plantation. There isn't essentially in Australia, there are, I don't know a ton about forestry there, but what I do know is that they don't have a tremendous lumber market because a lot of the gum species that they have don't yield great lumber, and so it's a big chip market, and a lot of their forest products industry is related to chip exporting to China, and because their forests are also is really essentially in a narrow band, Australia is largely a desert, and then along the coast is where all the agriculture and forestry ends up happening. But I think there must be a lot of forests there that are essentially riparian forests or not commercially managed. But I'm not an expert in Australian forestry.
Is there any technique that you can share with us about taking big blocks of wood out of a tree and also sharpening an axe? Do you do that yourself or do you send it out? How does that work?
Where do you want to start, with the big blocks of wood? Or
yeah, let's go with that.
More than half the year I spend my time, my business focuses on residential tree removal, and I'm a tree climber. We have an aerial, we have a bucket truck, but I do a lot of work along Otsego Lake where there's limited access. So it's a lot of rigging work. It's a lot of winching, a lot of pulleys, a lot of roping, that sort of thing. So rigging big wood out of a tree is all about making sure your rigging can first accommodate the pieces of wood that you're moving. But there's a lot of great tools out there that arborists use to be able to manage wood like that, friction devices. We use a tool called the Good Rigging Control System, the GRCS, and it's essentially a sailboat winch. And so we place a block in an appropriate place in the tree or create a spar pole and essentially turn those trees into a crane. And with that bollard winch, we can lift chunks up to 2,000 pounds and maneuver them around. And likewise, we can lower them with a single hand using that friction device or other friction devices. It's all about pulleys, leverage, winches, mechanical advantage when it comes to moving that big wood and not breaking stuff.
Sure. Porter wraps, whatnot.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, it's amazing. We had, do you know Ken Palmer from Arbormaster?
I don't.
Yeah, we had him on a few weeks ago. He's like the godfather of arboriculture, tree work.
Uh-huh.
You know, all these, you know, mechanical advantage and stuff, these terms and stuff. This guy was the pioneer in the 90s. But, yeah, you get a chance. Go back on that one, and he has a wealth of information.
Awesome. But, yeah, I will listen to that.
But, yeah, so let's get into a little bit about forest management here.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, because I read a lot about your timber sports. It's pretty neat. And but forest management, so you got out of the ranger school, which is a forest tech degree. It's an associate's in applied science. Taught a little bit about silviculture, touched upon those. Then you go to ESF, College of Environmental Science and Forestry in Syracuse, and they talk more about forest management. But then you go to the quote-unquote real world or Otsego County. And what was different when you first one out there, and you're trying to do forest management now.
Yeah. Well, I have to be honest in that a lot of my career path, for better or worse, the ability for me to be able to be my own boss and travel and compete as much as I wanted to really steered me towards being self-employed. And initially, we moved to where my wife grew up here. She works for SUNY Oneonta in the biological field station, and she's been there a long time. After she got her master's, she came back here, and it was a steady job. It was a great location, and I more or less said, well, I can do trees anywhere. And so we moved here, and I wasn't absolutely sure what I was going to do in combination with all of my lumberjack shenanigans. But I did a little bit of forestry consulting. I met with some people in the area, and I'll tell you, moving to a new location and not really knowing anyone and trying to start a forestry consulting business is not an easy task, especially pre-social media having those places to be able to advertise. But anyhow, I found it very difficult, and I guess it, at face value, it did not look like there was much opportunity to do forestry work here because I didn't know anyone, and I wasn't sure where to go to try and meet the right people. And a lot of the forestry work I was looking at ended up being what I would consider to be forest restoration work. So several occasions of high grading over 30 years, resulting in a stand of diseased beech, and situation similar, regenerated pasture that is only 35 to 50 years old and not even really ready for TSI. I found it a hard way to try and make a living. And I ended up sort of focusing more on the residential tree stuff, which is something, try to keep it quick, but my grandfather taught me to climb. He was a linesman for the telephone company, and we did trees together on the weekends when I was in high school. He taught me how to climb when I was about 14, taught me the basics of ropes, taught me how to tie a bowline, and taught me a lot of other things about life, really. And that's sort of where I got all of my my baseline for being able to do the residential tree work. And then once I started doing that again, I started reading a lot of books. There's a lot of great publications out there from the tree care, a lot of different tree care industry stuff out there. And I read and put it to practice, and I learned through doing. And that's really been what has carried me through and ultimately allowed me to buy my own skidder and start doing forest management work the way I wanted to do it myself. Because that was another challenge, was it's all well and good to be able to prescribe to make a silvicultural prescription, but to actually find a contractor who is able to do that kind of work is also a daunting task. So, yeah, before I keep rambling, I'll let you get caught up.
So with your current business now, you're more along the lines of being the forester and the logger at the same time, right, with your background and your degree at the ranger school.
Absolutely, yes. And some people or maybe a lot of people would see that as a bit of a conflict of interest, because one of the benefits of having a consulting forester is it's a neutral third party in a way. At least that's what I view it to be. However, when I meet with customers, and we talk about their forest. We'll go for a walk, and I'll educate them and try not to make any kind of sales pitch, just go through and talk to them. And I love forestry. I love the process. I love seeing trees grow. I just generally love forestry. And if I were able to financially do it, I think just doing forestry would be a lot better for my level of stress and that sort of thing. But again, the tree work is something I'm pretty good at, and so I go back to it. But anyhow, yeah, so it is a conflict, but I generally work with landowners who trust that what I am doing is for the benefit of the forest and also to meet their objectives. And I'm able to save them a little bit of money often because I am the forester at the same time as the contracted logger. And it doesn't mean I haven't done projects that were also also managed by a forester, but more often than not, I fill both roles.
So what are you doing with those diseased beech stands and those old pastures that aren't ready for TSI yet?
Well, it is a lot of case-by-case stuff. Generally, without having to resort to herbicides or things like that, we often work to encourage regeneration of all species and sort of try and overwhelm the beech. The time of year that you cut the beech, I think, can be important if this is the main objective. But we have had some pretty good success on some large acreage tracts where we essentially did a more or less a seed tree cut to encourage regeneration of other healthy species while leaving some beech in place to sort of with the idea of preventing them from sprouting out further. But that's been the tactic I've used, and maybe that's something I can learn from you guys as well on some other ways to maybe deal with beech.
Yeah, I mean, there's always herbicides, but we find that, I'd say, hinge cutting anecdotally seems to work in the summertime on beech.
Yeah,
late
summer hinge cutting, keeping that crown attached to the stump, they'll sucker out or coppice out at the point of cut, but not really root sucker too bad.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's anecdotal. We don't really have any data on that. That's just something we've noticed when we go back and visit our old cuts.
Nathan, it's so bad in some portions of south of you that we're just happy to get structure on the ground anymore. I mean, to get seedlings growing, I'll be honest. I mean, it's just so difficult with the deer browse pressure. When I go to Otsego, there's some really browsed areas, but it seems like it's a better site. You know, it does.
Yeah. We don't have widespread like I have seen it in other places, but it is something where you can see it starting to happen, and you try to deal with it at that point in time. I think especially these forests that have been high-graded over the years, where there's not enough sunlight really opened up for anything to grow but beech, or due to the deer browse, it's too easy to eat the other stuff. But where there's little holes here and there is where I often see these big patches of beech sprouting out. Even if it's not due to commercial activity, if a tree blows over and you're only talking about, say, a 50-foot hole in the canopy, the result is generally regeneration of beech. And so I think that I feel that it's best to, if you're going to regenerate something, you've got to give it lots of sunlight and try and encourage a broad mix of regeneration if possible.
Yeah. My job, our job here at the Catskill Forest Association, when we're not on the station, is mainly just talking about sunlight. Right, John?
That's a lot of it.
Whether it's arboriculturally or forestry, I would say it's sunlight, a lot of it. You know, who knew? We're going to take a break, Nathan. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic. Tonight's topic is Meet Timberworks Forest Management's Nathan Waterfield in Cherry Valley, and we'll be back. I want to ask Nathan about this mill he's got and this house he has made.
Life's tough, and then you die, and there ain't no rhyme or reason why. It comes right at you, so you do what you do. Love's great until it's not, hearts break. But the world don't stop when it rains, man, it pours. You can't change the course, you can wish on a star, but if it ain't in the cards, let it go. Sometimes you gotta let it go. Let it all wash on under the bridge. Blow it a kiss, give it a rest, cause it is what it is. Time flies while you save it all up. But someday this'll all be dust. It's all just stuff, it ain't never enough. And you can't take it with you, so you might as well just let it go. Yeah, you really ought to let it go. Let it all wash on under the bridge. Blow it a kiss, give it a rest, cause it is what it is. You never know what's waiting just up the road. Sooner or later that sun's gonna shine. Luck will turn on the dime. So when the good times roll, let them roll. But when they don't, let it go. Move on, keep moving till you see the light. The one that you've been waiting on, shining bright in the night, saying hey there friend, where the hell. Turn on a dime, and when the good times roll, let them roll. But when they don't, let it go. Let it go. You really gotta let it go. Let it go. Sometimes you gotta let it go. Let it go.
Right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. on WIOX Roxbury 91.3 FM. Tonight's topic is Meet Timberworks' Forest Management's Nathan Waterfield. And Nathan, I want to talk to you about this mill you got. And you made a house from all the stuff you cut down, is that right?
Yes. Yeah. It was about 10 years ago, built a house.
How'd that go?
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing.
Well, you know, my father was, he was a good carpenter and plumber and electrician, did it on the weekends, definitely a weekend warrior, so I definitely learned some things from him, but when it came to building a house, it was a lot more than that, but I was young. And I had the ambition, and I wasn't afraid to ask questions or ask for help when I needed it. But really, when I wanted to build a house, I wanted to build a post and beam timber frame, and that was essentially my goal. And I didn't really think much about insulation and electric and plumbing until I had already finished the frame.
Right.
But it with all of the sports stuff that I do and running my business, it took, I think, and I broke my leg halfway through the process, not while building my house, but for financial and other reasons, it was the majority of 4 years from breaking ground to when we moved in. And I think, like a lot of people who build their own house, there's still plenty of stuff that needs to be finished.
Everything's 90% done?
Yep.
Yeah, I know that
one. You got it.
So, you know, it looks like you provide three services. You do residential tree work, you do the forest management. Do you still do custom sawmilling?
Not really.
Yeah.
I do some if the situation is right. However, it's not something that I can do real well on, or feel even I can't charge what I would need to be able to not do the other stuff. And so there's between transportation setup and all the other pieces of the puzzle to custom milling, I think you have to be all in to be able to do it, and to just do it as an occasional thing. It just doesn't work. I feel like I would disappoint when I was advertising it. Oftentimes, it would take me forever to get to a place to be able to do it. But the flip side of that is I've done some really neat timber harvests where the landowner wanted to use some of the wood or all of it. For example, I did a timber harvest and harvested logs solely to mill out so this individual could build a timber frame post and beam barn. So it all came from his property. I did the forestry work, the logging work, then I milled out all of the timbers for him. And I would have loved to have built a barn too, but it's really veering off from from the focus of everything else.
Well, that's pretty cool. So how does this Peterson sawmill work? It's different than a band mill, right?
Yeah. So I have a swing blade mill, which is a portable sawmill with a 35-horsepower gas motor on it. And essentially what it does is, as you push the mill down the tracks, just like you would a bandsaw, you have a 26-inch circular blade that cuts from one side about, as most, it'll cut 10 inches deep. And you push it with the blade horizontal, and when you get through the log, you can flip the blade vertical, and the two cuts intersect perfectly. And once you have the wane cut off, you essentially produce a board with a down, going down, flipping the blade, and coming back. So the log doesn't move. The mill moves around the log. I describe it to some people as being sort of like a CNC machine that makes boards, because it has X, Y, and Z axis, and it moves itself. The cutting head moves itself around the log and cut out what you want from the log without flipping it or doing any of that.
Well, that's pretty convenient, because on a band mill, if you got to get that second cut, you got to turn the log 90 degrees.
Yeah, and you edge as you go. I think a lot of band sawyers, one thing they really don't enjoy doing is picking up the slab pieces and stacking them all back up on the mill and edging them.
Mm-hmm.
And so with this, you can edge as you go, and you get the curve is much more significant than a band. It's less than a quarter of an inch, like 3/16 of an inch, a little bit heavier than that. But the gains are realized in being able to mill the logs and get the full potential out of them, because you're not, as you move down through the log, you can maximize the width of the board. And it's also, what I really like about it is that I'm not having to sharpen it very often. It doesn't dodge knots, and it cuts extremely accurate lumber. If I want to make an 8x8, it is an 8x8. It's not an 8 1/4 in some places. It cuts very true, very true lumber, which is what I really like.
What's a disadvantage? Like, how does a band mill maybe? Why do people pick band mills, I guess?
These, I think in general, at face value, they look like they're expensive. If you compare, say, a 35 horsepower sawmill to this, at face value, they appear to be expensive. They're generally, there's two different brands that really lead the market. And I have a Peterson, and it's a great machine, but it's a lot of aluminum, a lot of stainless steel. They're built to withstand weather and built to really last your life. I think I would say that the disadvantage is that I think bandsawing is typically easier. I don't want to say it's easy, because you really need to know what you're trying to get out of the log, as you saw. But it's a little more complicated to do that one board at a time, and working with the axes, and just, I think there's a lot more resetting your gauges and that sort of thing. Every time you make a cut, you're at zero, and rather than making a cant that is 8 inches wide times your maximum width or something like that, so you can produce a whole bunch of 8-inch boards, you do them one at a time. So if I need 3 2x4s, a 1x6, and a 3x5, I could do it all out of the same log without any trouble. But I think it is a little bit of, you have to push it. There's certainly some manual labor. When you're cutting that kind of kerf, you have to push the mill a little bit harder than you probably have to do with a bandsaw. But I think the biggest disadvantage a lot of people talk about are the difference in the kerf, because you do make sawdust.
Yeah, right. What do you think, John? You run a mill. John runs a mill all the time.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's always intrigued me. I've seen at a couple fairs and festivals them running before. I've never had the opportunity to run one, but that kerf jumps out at me. That's a lot. I mean, that's double a band mill. And I think of the pile of sawdust I could make into the end of a day. You must be swimming in it.
Well, that's right. And that is, I think that is a big difference. And it's been a while since they had it, but they had I think it was called the Great Portable Sawmill Shootout. And I competed in that shootout, I think, five times. And the bandsaws would typically, in that competition, have about 15% overrun. Now, they would do international scale, and I think a lot of them were running about 15% overrun.
Yep.
And
pretty
on international scale, the best I ever did was like 102%. So 2% overrun, and more often I was closer to 95. Of course, you're going as fast as you can, and the idea is to put out board footage. So I think the best was like 960 feet an hour at 96% utilization, and that was going fast, like as fast as you really could go. But so that shows you there that there's probably 15%, easily 15% loss relative to what a bandsaw can do.
How about its portability?
Well, there's a bunch of different models, but when I've moved mine, I just put it on a trailer, but I've moved it in the back of a pickup truck. It kind of turns into a wheelbarrow, and you can load it into the back of a pickup truck without any machinery. But I always have a tractor on site anyways to move logs and load them up, so I just put them on the trailer and away you go. But it is neat. It doesn't have to have its own frame. The weight of the machine itself I've always dreamed it would be really cool to pack the thing back into the middle of nowhere somewhere and build a camp. Because you could totally do that. If you had four guys, it would be no sweat to take this thing off into the middle of nowhere and build a camp with it.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. That's the advantage of it, right? You could build the sawmill around the log and do it right there.
Be cool. Yeah, and the big thing, too, I suppose, and the thing that has always intrigued me and also sort of justify the cost of it is the capability. I can mill pretty much as big a log I could ever find in the East Coast. I could mill with this portable mill. It has about a 5.5-foot capacity, and to get a bandsaw that can cut that width is pretty hard to find, and they're very expensive. So that is one thing. If you do have access to big timber, that you can still mill it with this mill. If you really wanted to get into sawmilling, and you had a steady diet or a supply of 12-inch logs, I wouldn't recommend a swing blade sawmill. You can mill them with it, no problem. But the bigger the better when it comes to a swing blade mill.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Meet Timberworks Forest Management's Nathan Waterfield. We got about 4.5 minutes left, Nathan, and wanted to get your perspective of someone who makes a living from the forest on, you know, what are your biggest challenges in running your business and what's most gratifying?
Biggest challenges are certainly being able to be in five places at one time. I would love to be able to spend 1-2 days a week just walking properties with customers, but the reality is, it's hard to find employees. It's hard to find especially really good employees. And to be able to get all the work done that I'm asked to do, it's difficult to find the time for all of it. Yeah. And maybe redirect me here.
Well, yeah, I hear that from a lot of guys. In fact, a lot of guys who do residential tree work, they go into logging because they can't find people to work for them, and it's something they can do alone. Not that you should probably be working alone doing logging, but, you know, you can do it with one other person. Whereas tree work, I hear that a lot. I don't know. Is that what you're finding or no?
Well, I've been actively trying to find employees, and I have a lot of contacts with athletes in the sport coming out of school, and I talk to people from all over the country that are in the industry through the competitions that I do. So I'm always procuring employees, but it's a long, drawn-out process, and I've had some great employees who, because they were young, they moved off to other places to be with their girlfriend or their family again and that sort of thing. So it's just so hard. It's really hard to find good help. It's hard to find quality subcontractors. And most recently, trucking is a major issue. It's all well and good if you can cut 200,000 feet throughout the winter, but if you can't move at all, it's hard to get paid, and it's hard to take care of the roads and that sort of thing. So I think, yeah, just labor shortages in general are a big issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And got about 2 minutes left. What do you find most gratifying about it?
I think with any of this, I really like to please landowners, property owners, with the results. And there's nothing better than going back to some of these properties I started working in almost 10 years ago and be able to see the fruits of your labor with the regeneration, or go back to a tree that you've pruned out and it's growing beautifully, or visit a site where you removed a few trees, gave light to other trees, that sort of thing. Seeing the physical results of the work is really gratifying, and making customers happy is really what it's all about for me, for sure. One thing I did want to say is you had asked previously about coming out of school and then going into forestry, and what one of the, you know, some of the differences, what's different from what I learned in school. And I find that because I work on a lot of small acreages, I do a lot of single tree management. So there's generally a broad forest management goal, a silvicultural goal. However, I do a lot of single stem management. I look at each tree individually and think about the goals in mind and deal with trees on a case-by-case basis often. And maybe that a lot of that is because I am climbing in them so much through the year that I have an appreciation for each individual tree. But I felt like when we left school that forestry was a lot of trying to classify a broad forest stand as one individual, and treating a bit of acreage all with one prescription for the goal of making data collection easier. And that's something I never got into. I don't want plots that are always the same basal area, if you know what I mean.
I do. We're out of time, but I feel like we have that in common for sure. Came out of school with forestry and started getting pushed towards arboriculture, and I've tried to come up with a term that kind of bridges the two together, like backyard forestry or remote arboriculture. I haven't done it yet, or, you know, forest arboriculture, but kind of a mixture of the two. But that's all the time we have tonight, and it's been great, Nathan. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, and I do enjoy talking about it. It's great.
All right, thank you. Thanks for taking the time.
Yep, you're welcome.
All right, have a good night.
Bye.
All right, if you missed the show, that was Nathan Waterfield from Timberworks Forest Management over there in Cherry Valley, and we'll see you next week.
Good night, everyone.
Like a cold around him as upon his cot he lay, and he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way, getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name, and then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games in an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town.